for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The stakes are high for December's climate change summit in Copenhagen. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says world leaders hold in their hands the future of this entire humanity. Joining me to talk about prospects for a new international treaty to curb greenhouse gases, Connie Heidegaard. She's Denmark's climate and energy minister. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Juliet Eilbrun at The Washington Post. Good morning to you.
Nice to be here.
Paolo Sotero with the Wilson Center for International Scholars. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
And Kenneth Lieberthal of the Brookings Institution. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Diane.
And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Joining us before we begin our discussion here in the studio is Janos Pastor. He is director of the UN Secretary General's Climate Change Support Team. He joins us from his office in New York. Good morning, sir, and thank you for being with us.
Good morning.
Please tell us what you believe the summit hopes to achieve.
We will have next Tuesday here in New York a summit of over 100 heads of states and government. And the purpose of this summit is to inject political impetus and political vision into the negotiations that hopefully will come to success in Copenhagen at the end of the year in December.
How much do you believe industrialized countries will be willing to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases?
They are already reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and by coming together collectively, they will hopefully realize that they have not done enough yet, they have not pledged enough, and collectively they have to do more in order to reach the goals that we need to achieve so that we don't have irreversible impacts of climate change.
And what about major emerging developing countries like China and India? To what extent do you believe they will be willing to participate and make necessary changes?
I believe they will do that. They are already doing a lot. The question is how much more should they do and can they do in order to make sure that they also reduce the growth in their emissions. And many of the developing countries, such as India and China, have said that they are prepared to do more. But for that, they will need support, technological support and financial support.
And how much financial support are you talking about? How much financial support is actually needed, and where will that money come from?
The needs are quite substantial, but we're talking about over 10 and 20 years. But it can be in the many tens and hundreds of billions of dollars, but it's over a long period. Now we're talking about resources from the public sector, but we're also talking about resources from the private sector. They need to be channeled and scaled up to meet the needs, and it is perfectly possible to make this happen. What is needed is at the Copenhagen conference to make sure that governments agree on a formula on how to bring together the different sources of public and private funds to make this happen.
And I'd be interested, finally, if you could briefly outline for us the kinds of negotiations that must take place before the summit begins.
Well, the summit is beginning on Tuesday, and the formal negotiation process is taking place at different times. There will be a set of negotiations immediately after the summit in Bangkok for 2 weeks, 10 days, and then there will be another round in November in Barcelona before countries come together in Copenhagen at the end of the year to seal the final deal.
Janosch Pastor. He's director of the UN Secretary General's Climate Change Support Team. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And now turning to you, Kenneth Lieberthal, you have warned that global warming targets for the meeting are unrealistic. Why do you believe?
I think that it is going to be extraordinarily difficult to nail down targets across the board as quickly as this coming December. It worries me a little bit that the focus internationally, the public focus, has been almost wholly on the issue of targets in the global media, because that runs a very severe risk that the evaluation of Copenhagen will be that it has failed because there's not a final agreement on targets, and it will take a lot of the air out of the balloon as we continue to seek a final agreement. The Kyoto Protocol, which is now in force, goes through 2012. So we, in fact, have several years yet before we have to have a new agreement operational. And my feeling is there are a lot of issues that have to be addressed at Copenhagen to create the building blocks for a final agreement. Agreements on transparency, on verification, on measurement, on all kinds of other technical issues issues that make a final agreement meaningful. And so I would have Copenhagen focus on those building blocks and then have the targets committed to over the ensuing year or year and a half through an ongoing process.
Minister Heidegaard, do you also believe that the targets are too ambitious?
We all know it's very difficult to reach the targets, but we also know that science tells us that we must start reducing significantly now. And I can tell you from the European experience, where we have targets according to Kyoto, that actually the fact that we have these binding commitments, that has speeded up the activities that we have been taking. I mean, had it not been for targets, I can tell from my own country, Denmark, which has to reduce by 21% by 2012, lots of initiatives that are now being taken in the field of agriculture, transport, energy efficient standards for housing, things like that, we would never have done it. And I think it might interest your listeners that even last year, in the year of a crisis, our fastest growing export area in Denmark, that was within energy efficient technologies, just to say that if we see it holistically, then we can also create a new kind of economic growth here, and we can create jobs. But I agree with Lieberthal that it's, of course, very difficult to reach the most ambitious targets, but we should not exclude to try also and get the targets, because you know what? That will also be a precondition for having, for instance, China to commit herself to something in accordance with a new agreement.
Connie Heidegaard, she's climate and energy minister of Denmark. Also here in the studio, Kenneth Lieberthal. He's director of the John Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Juliette Alperin, talk about what you see as the sticking points for an agreement at Copenhagen.
Well, I think there are basically two different areas. One is the emissions gap, which is what we're talking about in terms of emissions targets, that there's both a question of how much the most developed countries are willing to commit in the coming decade or so, and then also what the major emerging economies, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, are willing to commit, things like that. So that's clearly one point of contention, and whether they can reach the goal that, as the minister referred to, of the scientific goal of keeping global temperature rise within 2 degrees centigrade or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. The second one is the financial gap. This is the question of how much money again, the major industrialized countries are willing to put forward for two purposes. First, for adaptation for the most vulnerable countries that haven't contributed to global temperature rise but are going to be most affected by it, whether
such as
Bangladesh, some of the smaller countries, Tuvalu, island states. So there's a real question of, you know, whether we were talking about sea level rise or more extreme weather. You know, how much money are, you know, when you look at sub-Saharan Africa, what's going to happen with drought? This is all a question of how much money are the richer countries willing to put on the table to help poor countries cope with climate change impacts? And then the second one would be how much money are, again, these countries willing to put on the table to help finance the technological innovations that would push for a shift to a low-carbon economy again, particularly in those major emerging economies that right now are building coal-fired power plants and other institutions that could contribute towards emissions in the coming decades.
Juliette Alperin, she's environmental reporter for The Washington Post. And turning to you, Paulo Sotero, you have said that Brazil and China are in something of the same kind of boat. What do you mean?
Well, Brazil, China, and India are countries that did not have responsibilities for the historic global warming reason, but they do now. Presently, they are big emitters. China is a big emitter. Brazil is fourth or fifth. The reason Brazil emits greenhouse gases through deforestation, 75% of our emissions, which is very different from China. China is more like the United States, burning fossil fuels. So there is a tremendous internal debate in Brazilian society that it's in our own best national interest to move this debate, because Brazil has the best energy matrix on Earth, and we can be a positive force in this debate.
Paulo Sotero, he's director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson International Center for Scholars. Welcome back. As we talk about the United Nations Climate Summit in Copenhagen, which is just weeks away, we have several guests with us. Connie Heidegaard is Climate and Energy Minister of Denmark. Juliette Alperin is environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Paulo Sotero is with the Wilson International Center for Scholars. Kenneth Lieberthal is at the Brookings Institution. We do invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Minister Heidegaard, in your mind, which countries should, must make cuts? And how large should those cuts be?
It goes without saying that those of us who are developed countries, who have the big lifestyle, of course, we must deliver the most first, and we must also deliver most as such. But as we also just heard, it's true that the equation simply will not fit if not the emerging economies somehow also can contribute. That might be through a deviation from business as usual in the short term, but in the longer term, all of us who are contributing significantly will have also to do something when it comes to pursuing a more green growth strategy and reducing our use of fossil fuels. And there are lots of ways we can do that. Lots of ways, lots of potentials in becoming more energy efficient, having more renewables, creating a lot of jobs. I mean, it is doable. But I believe that without, for instance, China contributing, then it is simply not possible to do what scientists tell us that we must do as responsible persons here at the beginning of the 21st century.
And Kenneth Lieberthal, what is China's argument?
China's argument fundamentally is that they are still early on in a growth trajectory. And as they grow, they need to build infrastructure, they need to build housing. It's worth keeping in mind that the U.S. has, I believe, a total of 9 cities that have a population of 1 million or more. Every single month, 1.25 million people in China move from the countryside into cities. And that rate of migration will continue for the next 15 years, every single month. So every month, they have to build the equivalent of a new city for a relatively poor population of 1.25 million people. And that requires housing, schools, transportation, et cetera, which requires cement and steel, et cetera. So they say they are willing to do a lot to reduce emissions as against the current trends. In other words, they're trying to become much more efficient, shift to renewables, increase mileage standards for their vehicles, and so forth. But to say that their emissions have to peak any time, they would argue, in the next 15 years to 20 years is simply unrealistic. Now, there can be arguments about where the peak should be, but certainly I very much agree with the minister that in the short term, the issue is how much can they reduce as against trend rather than can they reduce absolutely their carbon emissions.
It's just not feasible. Aren't they also arguing that because the United States is the consumer country and China currently becomes the manufacturing country, that there needs to be a break there?
That is part of their argument, and it's complicated even more by the fact that many of the manufacturers in China are, in fact, Japanese, Americans, Canadians, and Europeans. So there's a complicated argument here. But at the end of the day, the minister is absolutely right. Either we find a way to attack this problem in a major way, or we all are in deep, deep trouble.
And Paolo Sotero, you talked about deforestation as being one of the greatest problems that Brazil has. How is the government of Brazil willing to face this problem, to tackle it, to become one of the participating nations?
Brazilian government is responding to pressures from society. People now is increasingly understanding
its own society.
Yes, its own society, that the Amazon is a national treasure. We need the Amazon standing because the Amazon governs the rain patterns in Brazil and in South America, which makes the Brazilian agriculture the most productive in the world. Farmers in Brazil are increasingly embracing that. And the government of Brazil has announced a plan of action on climate change that aims at a 70% reduction in deforestation in the next 5 years. Last year, the reduction was by 50%. Mm. It is a matter how we finance that, how we pay to find a way that the standing forest will be more valuable economically than the destroyed forest. And this is the challenge, and this is the debate going on in Brazil, and I believe in the right direction.
Juliet Eilperin, there are key differences existing now between the U.S. and the European countries on Kyoto. I mean, basically on Kyoto, the U.S. is talking about stepping away from Kyoto altogether. What are the key differences there?
Well, a lot of it does come down, it comes down to two things. One is this idea of in Kyoto, you obviously had this distinction between the major industrialized countries and everybody else. And there actually is a great deal of, I think, emerging agreement, even on the part of major emerging economies such as Brazil and China, that they have to be part of the deal. So that's part of how everyone wants to kind of step back from Kyoto, and there's not as much debate on that. Part of what's happening, and this reflects in many ways the political challenges that the administration is facing here at home in terms of enacting our own cap and trade bill on climate is that basically there's a question of whether nations should set their own domestic targets and you'll cobble those together and have those amount to a deal, or how much do you have to be bound by an international treaty. And one thing that I think is interesting, and I'm sure Minister Hedegaard could speak to this, but the Europeans being in a union right now have been on a certain level relinquishing sovereignty to a group in order to come up with cohesive standards. And that's obviously something that the United States has not been doing, and that's part of the reason you're seeing this disconnect.
And, of course, the United States has its own political problems to wrestle with as the Congress looks at capping emissions, Minister
Hedegaard.
Yeah,
you're right that you have your own problems in this country, but remind you that all kind of democracies have problems. So it's not so that it's very easy for Europeans or a new Japanese government or whatever. I just think that many governments around the planet have realized that the Chinese will be doing this no matter what. And that is sometimes as if people tend to forget that. I mean, the world's largest exporter of energy-efficient technologies this year is going to be China. China is right now the country in the world installing most wind capacity, most solar capacity, things like that. So if you look at this in a greater strategic perspective, we are also discussing who is going to have the strategic and the economic leadership of the 21st century.
And who's going to have the political will
exactly
to move forward on this.
Exactly. And those who think, oh, no, now we must be cautious because what if what with competitiveness? I just say, I'm in no doubt, China and others, they are already moving and they can move fast. Also because they don't have as many democratic problems and challenges as we have, having it through their parliament. They can be very efficient when they start to realize this is in their own interest. And that was actually what the Chinese leadership said a few weeks ago. They know they cannot have their growth rates unless they themselves address climate change. And I think that also an American audience should be very much aware of that.
And I wonder whether the United States audience is very much aware of that, Juliet.
I don't think they are. And in fact, again, when I talked to a number of senators last week about the prospects for climate change legislation. And again, you hear the concern they have that China and India aren't doing enough. There clearly is a distinction I would make between China and India. China is doing a tremendous amount in terms of working to cut its emissions. And I don't think you can say the same for India. But when you look at the domestic audience, there's a perception that the Americans are going to be asked to do a tremendous amount, and you're really not asking that much of major emerging economies. And it's clearly a stumbling block in both producing legislation that would later empower U.S. negotiators to forge some kind of significant agreement.
Paolo.
Being a developing country, democracy is not does not prevent you from acting. In Brazil, for instance, gasoline is the alternative fuel for light vehicles. Brazil has evolved. So the argument that China can do it better because it's a closed system, it doesn't play in Brazil because we are not going to change our system. We are a Western democracy and we are making progress. It's impossible to engage. It's possible. It's necessary to engage society in this debate. We showed this in Brazil is happening and you can make progress. Now, I think Brazil wants to have an important role in Copenhagen. The calculation in Brazil is increasingly that the deal is possible, probably in the following meeting that I believe will take place in Mexico.
Kenneth Lieberthal.
American domestic politics can fail us dramatically here. I believe that President Obama is going to have to use all of his skills and all of his resources with the bully pulpit in the White House to educate the American public on the realities of the damage that climate change now does to the United States, the realities of how it will affect our economy and our security in the future, and the reality that we need to move on this. Otherwise, members of Congress, even Democrats from heavy manufacturing states, from big coal states, are not going to support serious legislation, and we will all be in very deep trouble.
But at the same time, just recently, we heard the U.S. Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, say, quote, let's not, and he was speaking about Copenhagen, he said, let's not make that one particular time the be-all, end-all, and say if it doesn't happen that we're doomed. He went on to say, we can come back in 2 to 4 years' time. What's your reaction, Juliet?
Well, certainly, if you talk to a lot of the people who are invested in this process, they would say there's political momentum now. And to certainly completely punt in Copenhagen, I think, would spell disaster for the prospects of an international agreement. There is a discussion, and I think the question is very much open, of whether you could get some sort of political agreement which would form the basis for a binding legal agreement the next year in Mexico City. And I think a lot of people are debating whether that's an acceptable option. But to completely downplay Copenhagen, which the administration is doing for obvious reasons, certainly could undermine the prospects of a binding global pact that would last for a few years.
Minister, but can I just add, nobody expects Copenhagen to deliver all the nitty-gritty details so that we won't have to discuss climate for the next 5 or 10 or 20 years. Nobody believes that. But we must have sort of the overall political deal. Why? Because it's always so easy when you have a common deadline coming closer then to postpone it. But we do not know. Will the world situation be better next year? Suddenly, maybe some of our countries will be very much stuck with a difficult war in Afghanistan. There can come another economic crisis or whatever. So sometimes internationally, you should also use the opportunity when the window is open. And that window of opportunity, that is right now.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones. Your turn to participate in our discussion, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Athens, Ohio. Good morning, Chad. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's good to be on.
Thanks.
I've witnessed horrific impacts of climate change in the Arctic in my 4 expeditions up to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Massive ice and the Native Americans not knowing where to get their food that they've lived on for tens of thousands of years. And Greenpeace International.
You know, I'm sorry, Chad, but your line is breaking up on us and it's very hard to understand. Perhaps if you can call us back on a landline, we'd be happy to hear your call. Let's go now to Bill, who's in Stafford, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I'm amazed at a couple of things that I've heard today, specifically the statement made by the UN minister that China feels they need technology and money to go ahead and do this. And then we hear from your esteemed guests that they are the leading exporter of technology to actually fix this problem, and it's really clear that they have a huge surplus of money, of U.S. dollars, in their bank accounts. So it seems to me they're kind of just stretching to get as much as they can to get all of the rest of the world to pay for something that they're really in need of doing.
Well, of course, Bill, nobody things of giving away technologies, for instance, from the United States or Europe to China. Everybody can see that is not viable. And I mean, in our societies, technologies are owned by private companies. That's not something that politicians can give away. But we could be better at cooperating when it comes to develop new technologies, the technologies of the future. And there I think it would be very interesting if we, across boundaries, across nation states, actually could have a much better way of cooperating on research and demonstration projects in the large scale. So in the large scale. So that is some of the issues that are on the table when we're discussing a more close technology cooperation.
But at the same time, there is that question underlying Bill's observation that China is asking for more and more and more. And yet, is it going to get more, and where is that more going to come from, Kenneth?
I think China is playing the role here of representing the third world or developing world overall. And in the group of 77, certainly there are a lot of countries that need help financially and that need help with technology development. So I think this is more China wearing that hat. And obviously China would like to get as much as it can get for as little as it has to pay in terms of financial support and technology. But I think realistically what the minister just said is correct, which is to say on the Chinese part, what we really should be looking for is co-development of technology, getting the key capabilities transnationally together to develop technology that we can then test and scale up and make viable at a commercial
level. But is that cooperation truly there? Is it on the board, ready to go?
I think, you know, I've looked especially at U.S.-China cooperation in clean energy. And there are certainly a lot of areas where our capabilities right now are very complementary, where we can do a lot more together than either of us can do on our own. So it makes sense to get that kind of cooperation going. We are in early days of having that cooperation, so we have to do a lot to develop it.
Kenneth Lieberthal of the Brookings Institution. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments, and email. Do join us. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. By Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. And by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Behind the headlines of the recession, a New York Times correspondent on ordinary people whose lives were upended by risk and easy money, and how to renew American economic stability. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And as we talk about the upcoming climate summit in Copenhagen, that's just weeks away, here's an email that's come to us from Dee, who says, in country comparisons, how relevant and useful a metric is per capita emissions? For example, India has argued it has very low per capita emissions, even as compared to other large developing countries like China. Can you answer that, Julia?
I think it basically depends on your rubric, which is from a political standpoint, these things are important because, again, as your caller is pointing out, there's this distinction and there's an equity question. From a scientific standpoint, it's meaningless. Emissions are emissions, and they're fueling the changes that we're seeing in the environment and the climate. And so certainly they have to be factored in when you're talking about the equity of a political deal. But in terms of if you're looking at getting a goal that's going to cut emissions, that can't be the deciding factor when you're determining what kind of emissions cuts you're going
to
get.
All right. To Greenbackville, Virginia. Good morning, Ann. You're on the air.
I just have a couple of comments to make, and these are, first of all, I heard one of your guests say that if Obama doesn't do this and that and the other, we're going to be in deep trouble. I have been listening to your shows for I don't know how long now, but at every turn, you underestimate the president. You don't show him respect. How do you expect other countries to have respect for our decisions, our president's decision, when we can't even respect him?
I think there's a great deal of respect out there for President Obama. And
oh, no. I've been listening to you for I don't know how many weeks now, and even while you were off, it is so negative. That's what I'm getting. It's very, very negative.
All right. I appreciate your comments. And perhaps Anne has a point when you hear the critics from one side or another. I think in this discussion, the question is, has the Obama administration made the right decision in terms of the environment, or is it the right decision from a political standpoint, and can the two ever, ever be separated?
Diane, can I just tell Anne a story? I have a boy who's 16 years old, and in the very early months of the Obama presidency, suddenly one day I came up to his room, and he had painted President Obama's picture on the wall. I mean, but think about it, because it's something about a whole young generation internationally suddenly setting the United States very, very high in esteem.
Inspired.
And there are so many expectations out there. And that is, of course, also why it's so important that the U.S. now shows leadership here, or you will disappoint this. I mean, it's fabulous that a whole, for those of us who love the United States, it's fantastic that a whole new international generation has so high expectations to the United States.
The United States was out of this debate for 8 years, even denying scientific evidence at the government level. President Obama, among other merits, has the merit of having brought back this discussion to the center of the agenda. He is very admired in Brazil for this and for other reasons.
I made the comment earlier that Anne was just objecting to, and let me just make very clear, President Obama has the right priorities on this issue. He has brought in the right team to deal with this issue. My comment was simply that the politics of the issue on the Hill are very, very tough, and the president has to use his enormous skills in order to create the political environment that lets people on the Hill do the right thing. So that was not indicating a lack of confidence in him. It's great confidence in him, but as soon as we get beyond health care, he has got to throw himself completely into this if it's going to work on Capitol Hill.
But can he do both in the same period of time? Some people are saying that with the health care debate front and center, the promises on greenhouse gases, the promises on global climate change are very difficult to meet, Juliet.
There's no question it's taken up the oxygen on Capitol Hill, and part of the issue is just one of timing. I don't think people doubt that President Obama and his team will push for climate change legislation once they're done with health care. But the fact that that debate has gone on longer than people expected does make it difficult for us to certainly see a bill passed by the Senate in time for the negotiations at Copenhagen.
All right. And here's an email from Rich, who says, given that Western nations import so many products and goods from China and India, and the fact that these countries do not adhere to their own environmental protection regulations that are enforced in the Western world, how much influence, pressure, and enforcement can Americans and other consuming or importer nations put on China and India in order to reduce their greenhouse gases? You see, I think this goes back to the issue of, do Americans know that China, specifically, is attempting to do a great deal? India, less thus far. Juliet.
Yeah, clearly that's what you're having. Although I think there is a question, and this is something that comes up in the context of UN negotiations, how reportable and verifiable will the reductions that these major emerging economies are committing to be? And so I think that there really will be a debate, but it seems that's a secondary debate, this idea of if they make these commitments, there will be a huge amount of pressure from people in industrialized countries to make sure that the cuts in emissions they're making are real. And again, you can see there's a deep amount of skepticism among the American public of whether that's going to happen, and they don't want to jump first. Part of this is about, is everyone willing to jump together and make joint commitments or not?
Mr. Heidegger.
And that's why it's so important to have China to be a part of this. For instance, if we take some electrical appliances being produced in China, they will consume 4, 5, maybe 6 times as much energy by being produced in China compared to if they were produced, for instance, in Europe, because we're much more energy efficient. So that shows that it would really also benefit China itself to find much more energy efficient ways of doing that, and it would be to the benefit of all of us. But we should sort of bring them into this so that we will not repeat Kyoto with all the major economies not being part of that.
All right.
They have to be in the 21st century.
Let's go now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Mike.
Hi. I just had a comment about the fact that the motivation level to change behavior here in the States is extremely low. And I think one of the reasons is that the media is abdicating its responsibility to create a warranted sense of threat and crisis. I mean, the science warrants that we'd be in a state of panic about this, and the media has dropped the ball completely. I saw a glimmer of hope after Al Gore's movie came out. It seems like they ramped up the frequency of coverage and the sort of, you know, sense of gravity around the whole issue, but it seems to have dropped off completely.
It's interesting. I think Mike has a good point in that, as you said, Juliet, the healthcare debate has taken up so much space in newspapers, room on airtime, and so on.
That's certainly true. But I think if you look in the broader perspective, particularly in the last couple of years since the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in early 2007 issued its report talking about the unequivocal link between human activities and warming and talking about the impacts of that, we regularly have front page stories, as do every major U.S. newspaper, on the impacts, whether it's in the Arctic, in the United States as well. But there's no question that in the immediate past, we've seen such a focus on healthcare, you haven't seen the same altitude to those stories.
Interesting, Paolo. How much news coverage about this would you see in Brazil?
Very much so.
Very much.
Yes, growingly. Television programs, newspapers have now correspondents assigned to this. And this has been actually what has moved this debate. You have the largest soybean farmer in Brazil now has turned to more an environmental responsible position. It's very much the government, there is an alliance of businesses pressuring the government to assume a more proactive position in Copenhagen, to take some distance from China in terms of what we are going to propose, because we are a fuel-efficient country and we should take political advantage of that fact. Having said that, all Brazilians understand one fact. If we do everything we have to do to protect, save, and preserve the Amazon, and the world continues to burn fossil fuels as they are, the Amazon will be turned into a savanna. So this is the big challenge for us, and this is, we have this in mind, and our leaders have this in mind.
And here's a question going in a somewhat different direction from John in St. Louis, Missouri, who says, unless we significantly reduce the world's population and replace our fossil fuel plants with nuclear generating facilities, we'll have negligible effects on global warming. Politicians and policy wonks are trying to sound good, but might as well attempt to empty the oceans with a teaspoon. Now, there are two points there, reducing or slowing the world's population, and the second, nuclear energy. Minister Heidegaard.
Well, first about the population growth. That is very true what John says, that is one of the main challenges. We are 6.6 billion people on planet Earth today.
Is anybody going to talk about that?
No, but that's the whole... We know that that is why, somebody will have to address that, another UN agency, things like that. I'm not going so much into that. We cannot solve that in Copenhagen this December. But it is a fact that we are going to become 9 billion people on planet Earth at the middle of this century. So we are forced to find more clever, smart ways to get our growth, or we will get stuck in water problems, pollution problems, all kind of resource problems. So this climate agenda is also about, where is our energy going to come from? How can we have energy security? How can we be more independent of importing fossil fuels from different unstable regimes, things like that? Because while we also have, and I agree with John, we have to address that population growth challenge, it will be a fact that it will be increasing very dramatic in the next few decades.
What about the question of nuclear energy? Will that likely come up at the talks?
Well, nuclear energy is clearly part of the solution, and we're seeing an acceleration of movement to build more nuclear plants now globally. I think it will begin to pick up in the U.S. China has the largest nuclear power plant construction program in the world right now. But nuclear alone is not going to do it and not going to come close to doing it. These plants are very capital intensive. They take a while to build. They have safety issues associated with them, and the politics of them can be very tough. So we need to do everything is the bottom line. This problem is moving so rapidly, and the changes needed are so substantial that we can't leave any stone unturned on this particular issue.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to David, who's in Mishawaka, Indiana. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
My question is, this discussion is pretty much about reducing greenhouse gases from fossil fuels and all that. But what I'd like to know is there anything being done about the greenhouse gases that are... the excess greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere, because it seems to me like, it's causing a great deal of damage as it is. Are we just going to accept that?
All right. Thanks for calling, Minister.
Well, David, the problem is that the gases that we have already emitted, so to speak, they will be there for many, many years to come. And that is, of course, why we must also try to listen to science. And they say if you continue to emit and emit even more, then you're in for catastrophe. And that is why what we can do is to sort of take care, when do we peak global emissions and when can we make them be reduced? That is a challenge. That's what we can do something about.
Finally, Paolo, what do you expect, what do you hope will come from these Copenhagen discussions?
A political agreement on a framework. I think it's too little, and we don't have much time to go into targets, but as the minister said, it is important to get a political understanding and to change substantially the understanding on the role of the developed and the developing country on this. If we get that in Copenhagen, it will be a substantial result.
Kenneth.
I would agree with that. The way I would put it is we need a Copenhagen to agree on the architecture of a final agreement. And I would hope that part of that would also be substantial progress on what I earlier termed the building blocks of that agreement, a lot of the issues that have to be addressed. But the final agreement will have to be negotiated after Copenhagen, hopefully based on increased momentum coming out of the success at Copenhagen of defining the architecture that we can all agree to.
And do you expect that which you've just outlined will be achieved?
I think if we focus on that, it is feasible, yes.
Juliet?
Well, I'll just talk about expectations, and I would say that my expectations is that right now it is more likely than not that there will be some sort of political deal, just because I think there's such enormous pressure to make it happen, but it's not guaranteed. And beyond that, I don't think you're going to see the kind of solid legal agreement that people initially thought was in the cards.
And finally, Minister Heidegaard.
We must have a political binding agreement that is strong enough to make it credible that we actually stay on the track. Scientists tell us that at least we should stay below the 2 degrees, and it must be a truly global agreement, and then there will be nitty-gritty things and details that will have to be dealt with later.
How optimistic are you?
All kind of journalists always ask me that. I'm a pessimist or an optimist. I'm a realist, but I think that realistically, we must do it now. And as I said earlier on, if we don't do it now, you never know when the chances will be there again. Now the momentum has build up, and I believe that the political price for not being able to deliver in Copenhagen would be so high that no government can afford to pay it.
Connie Heidegaard, she is Climate and Energy Minister of Denmark. Juliet Eilperen is an environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Paulo Sotero, he's director of the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center for Scholars. Kenneth Lieberthal is at the Brookings Institution. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.